Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
I'm Matt Clifford, co-founder and CEO of Entrepreneur First.
Matt, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today. Before we dive into Entrepreneur First and everything you guys are building there, which is super exciting, I can't wait to dive in a little bit deeper. Give us a high-level kind of a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Yeah, so I started Entrepreneur First with my co-founder, Alice Bentinck, nearly 10 years ago. So it's really what I've been doing for the vast majority of my career. Before that, I was a management consultant at McKinsey in company in London, which is where I met Alice. And before that, I was a graduate student at MIT.
Wow, that's super exciting. And, you know, I would imagine the experience as a management consultant, I come from a similar path. A lot of great experience that came out of that. But, you know, having been working on Entrepreneur First for 10 years, that's very impressive. So bring us back a little bit to the time when you've met Alice and you guys were, collaborating on different projects and whatnot. How did the whole idea about Entrepreneur First come about?
Yeah. So I suppose the story for me really starts even earlier than that, in that the core thesis of Entrepreneur First is that the world's missing out on some of its best founders. And what we mean by that is that there are many people who would be good entrepreneurs who find themselves pulled into other career paths and then never get back out of them into starting companies. And so, you know, everything we do is about trying to make entrepreneurship the number one career choice for ambitious people. And so when I look at my own career, in a way, and I think Alice would say the same, what we're building for ourselves as we were, in that, you know, how did I end up becoming a management consultant? You know, honestly, it's quite hard to say. I remember as a teenager, I was fascinated by technology. You know, I didn't want to get a Saturday job. So I ended up sort of learning to code and like building websites for money and fixing my parents' friends' computers. But it never occurred to me sort of in the like late 90s, early 2000s in the UK that I could or should have a career in technology entrepreneurship. No one was talking about that. It wasn't an option. So, you know, when I applied to university and, you know, in the UK, you have to declare a major, you know, before you apply, I was like, well, I'm going to do history. And it didn't occur to me that would not be necessarily the best preparation for a career in technology. And then when I got to university, you know, I did my undergrad at Cambridge University in the UK. And, you know, I graduated just before the financial crisis. And at the time, the joke at Cambridge was kind of like, you know, when you're picking your post-university career, you can be a banker, you can be a management consultant, or you can be a failure. What do you want to be? And that was, I'm exaggerating, but it was sort of the attitude was that, you know, there were this very narrow range of career options. And so I applied to be a management consultant because it's what everyone else was doing. And so when we found ourselves at McKinsey, which I have to say was a great experience, the people were great, the work was interesting. So much of, you know, like what I use today are things I learned at McKinsey. But nevertheless, it did feel to me like, it's weird that this place is full of people who say that they want to ultimately be doing something else. They want to be founders. They want to be, you know, entrepreneurs. And so what we got thinking about was, what would an institution look like? A new kind of institution that would attract the kind of ambitious, competitive, driven individuals that get pulled into financial services, professional services, corporate career paths, but instead pull them into entrepreneurship. And that was the seed, that was the starting point for Entrepreneur First back then. Lots has changed from the original sort of, you know, way we got started, but that thesis actually is pretty much 10 years on exactly what we do today.
Wow, that's fascinating story. And thanks for sharing that, a little bit of a background. It definitely resonates on so many levels because, you know, during my time, you did studies at MIT. Similarly, I was on the other side at Harvard. A lot of my cohorts and, you know, the fellow alumni, went the path of management consulting or went to, you know, the finance route, go into private equity and so forth. It was never even, you know, a conversation amongst us going into starting our own companies or anything.
Right.
That was the case. But being kind of very similarly an entrepreneur first, I've always tinkered with, you know, just building. And yeah. I've, as a serial entrepreneur, I successfully failed a lot of my startups. I had decent outcome with one, but I'm always kind of fascinated with that transition first as an entrepreneur and then going into the route, at least for me as an angel investor and now running kind of a mini venture fund, almost paying it forward in terms of that experience going through building companies and growing fundraising. I think it's, you know, for me, it's very interesting with what you're building at Entrepreneur First. So tell us a little bit about the very kind of the initial cohorts that you guys had hosted. What have you learned from that? And how has that changed the overall kind of vision of where the Entrepreneur First is at now?
Yeah. So I would say it took us 3 years to really figure out what we were doing, what the model should be, what the right product, if you like, to offer founders was. I mean, we were lucky that we started pointed in the right general direction, but lots changed. So the initial idea was to take people as they graduated from university and put them in a community together to help them find co-founders and sort of provide a peer support group as like a handful, one of the few people basically who was like deliberately avoiding the traditional career path and going to try it themselves. We didn't at that time think of ourselves as an investor. That wasn't the original plan at all. It was very much like, we'll build these communities. It will be about sort of peer-led support, be about finding people within that community to work with. Yes, we'll connect people into investors, but you know, we thought that our business model would be a sort of corporate sponsorship. We then ran the first program and two things happened. One, we got fantastic applicants from day one, like to our surprise. And, you know, it's one of those things, people talk about product market fit, which is definitely one of the most important ideas for entrepreneurs to get their heads around. The idea that like, there's a real difference between when you're having to push the product and when people are pulling it from you. We just had product market fit from that idea from the start. It turned out that there were hundreds of people in the UK who had that like feeling of discontent with the options available to them. So, you know, the first cohort, we started very small. We took 30 individuals and to our, and I think everyone else's surprise, they ended up building, I think sort of 10 companies in that first cohort, I think almost all of which managed to raise seed funding. And it just became quite clear that there was something quite special about the network effect, the community effect of putting these people together. So we iterated a bit. We decided to raise a very small fund. I mean, really small, a few hundred thousand pounds to basically do a second cohort. And this time we would fund the companies that came out of that. And that worked pretty well. And, you know, we have had some great successes out of that cohort. And I think at this point we were like, well, it seems to be working. Like, how do we scale it? And what we hit upon was that one of the big barriers or bottlenecks rather to scale was that we were basically asking people to take a bet before they knew who they were going to work with and what they were going to work on and ask them to spend several months figuring that out, but without really being able to pay them. I mean, like we were investing in companies once the companies created, but there was this gap. And so we ended up inventing a new form of financing for entrepreneurs, which is one of the things we're proudest of. We call it a stipend option contract. And basically it's a deal that we make with every founder that joins us, which is we'll pay them living costs for 3 months to allow them to spend 3 months exploring teams, exploring potential co-founders, exploring ideas in exchange for the right to invest in anything that they create during that period. In a way, today that probably sounds really obvious, but it was quite radical at the time, the idea that you would literally pay people to become founders before you knew whether there was anything to invest in. Anyway, it turns out to be a really good deal for founders. It gives them the time and space they need. And it's a really good deal for our investors because they get the chance to be the first check in to companies that go on to be very exciting. So from there, it really started to explode. We we ran a few more cohorts in London. We started doing them twice a year. We started increasing the cohort size. And then starting in 2016, we expanded to Singapore. And then after sort of 2018, really grew a lot faster. We added Paris, Berlin, Bangalore, and most recently last year, Toronto. So today, Entrepreneur First funds about 800 entrepreneurs a year globally across our programs and cities.
Well, that's super exciting. And it's always interesting to hear kind of that, how much of a pivot and just the overall process, how the overall vision changes from the very beginning, just like in any typical startup as well.
Right.
You have to adapt, you have to adjust. And that's fascinating. You've mentioned you've gone beyond kind of that geographical allocation where you originally started, obviously in UK, going into Singapore and other locations worldwide. How has the COVID situation impacted in a positive or a negative way in terms of being able to scale geographically, handling everything remotely? I'm fascinated by that topic, which seems to be pretty beat down these days. But as I interview a lot of executives of Fortune 500 and or, you know, entrepreneurs or the investors, everyone is in very similar boat in a sense, creating the kind of the operations to be able to adjust to that. Tell us a little bit more about that experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the sort of headline is probably that to our surprise, and I think to most people's surprise, COVID ended up being, for at least from an economic perspective, a surprising tailwind for technology. So like actually for, without in any way diminishing the human tragedy of it and the economic tragedy in a lot of sectors, you know, I think we were all worried in March of 2020, but actually it probably ended up being the best ever year to be a software entrepreneur or certainly a software investor, because suddenly the power of remote, the power of global collaboration was unleashed on the world in this mass forced experiment that half the world suddenly had to work from their bedrooms. And I think this did a number of different things. One, it obviously made us think hard about like the software and hardware infrastructure we need to enable that. And that's obviously why, you know, public companies like Zoom ended up having such incredible runs, but lots of smaller companies as well. Second, I think it just made particularly big companies realize both that they had to and could transform their businesses through software. And so, you know, what we saw was like all-time high demand from enterprise clients to buy software to make them more efficient and effective. So when you put those together, plus the fact that, you know, global central banks lowered interest or kept the extraordinary experiment in zero interest rates going even further, which meant that, you know, the world was awash with relatively cheap capital. It's been an extraordinary period for venture-backed businesses. Now, we've benefited from that for sure. And, you know, we 2020 ended up against all the odds being our best economic year so far. But I would say we've added, you know, we created more enterprise value in the first 6 months of 2021 than in the whole of 2020. So it's definitely a bull market for tech. I think offsetting that, you know, for us, it definitely introduced a lot of challenges. So the Entrepreneur First program is primarily about finding a co-founder. And that's primarily an activity that we have done in person, in a single building in each city, lots of people in a room, meeting, chatting, talking, brainstorming, like going off in a little meeting rooms. All of that went away overnight. And so we had to rethink our product for entrepreneurs just literally overnight. And so that was a real test. And, you know, I was nervous. And, you know, huge credit to our team. They really found ways to make it work. Ways to use software, to use, you know, Zoom to help people find and experiment with co-founders online. Now, I would be lying if I said we decided we never want to go back and all works online. You know, actually, we're really thrilled to be able to do some of this in person again now. But it did open up, like, it definitely made us question some of how we did business. You know, like, not everything we do does need to be offline and in person. And, you know, I think while we're definitely pleased that in some locations we're able to be back in the office, it does, the one thought I would really emphasize is it makes you realize what talent pools there exist in the world outside major physical hubs, that if you can do the remote thing well, you can tap into for the first time. And that's good for them. It's good for the world. It's good for the companies that are able to do it. And I think it's, you know, it's fantastic for innovation. So it's, yeah, it's been a mixed year, but overall, I think it has demonstrated both the power and potential of technology.
Right, right, right. No, that's definitely a fascinating space, especially now going into the next period to see how things play out.
Yeah.
So to, you briefly mentioned, you know, an opportunity to discover an untapped talent in terms of founders in, you know, different markets. What has been the most surprising location-wise discovery for you when it comes to, you know, finding those very unique set of founders outside of the obvious, you know, large markets? What have you seen come out of this exercise or this period where you're like, oh wow, I've completely overlooked this area? Because, and I'll give you an example. I'm originally from Kazakhstan. I was born there, but right. I lived in the US, you know, most of my life. And, you know, through the investments that I've been making lately have been Kazakhstan and also Lithuania, because of the high condensation of, you know, very unique technology talent.
Yeah.
So those have been like mind blowing to me in terms of the discovery. So curious to get your take on some of your discoveries lately.
Yeah. Well, I think I would put the most interesting things under the category of surprising concentrations of talent. And what I mean by that is, I think sometimes it's very tempting, particularly if you sit, you know, like in London or New York or somewhere that is relatively low friction to go in and out. It's sort of easy to think of the world as flat and like, you know, like, therefore, you know, everyone is where you expect them to be. And, you know, all these like clusters, you know, kind of just aggregate all the talent. And I think what's interesting is actually where the world is inefficient and surprising. And so you get these unusual clusters. And one of the ones that I always think about and has been just an incredibly rich seam of talent for EF is we have ended up funding an extraordinarily high proportion of Iranians in Singapore, which sounds so weird. Like there are only, I think, I mean, this is slightly old data, but, you know, as far as I know, there's about 200 Iranians in Singapore. We have funded about 30 of them. And the reason is that for one of these reasons that's kind of fascinating around talent aggregation. So Singapore is home to two world-class universities, NUS and NTU. And, you know, they're both like global top 20 universities. But what's really interesting is if you're from Iran, if you're like a super smart undergrad in Iran and you want to go and do graduate studies in, I don't know, something like that even vaguely touches on like security issues. There are a lot, and you look down the list of like the best universities in the world, you basically end up crossing off the US because it's pretty hard to get a visa to do it. And you actually increasingly cross off the UK. I mean, these are not, I don't mean it's black and white, but like it's hard, cross it off. The number one university in the world, when you cross off all the places that it's really hard for Iranians to get visas to do graduate studies, the number one university in the world becomes the National University of Singapore, NUS. And so there is an amazing concentration of extremely smart graduate talent in science and technology subjects concentrated in Singapore. So when we go out and try and find like exceptional technologists to build tech companies in Singapore, they're disproportionate. I mean, obviously we funded a lot of people in Singapore. Most of them are not Iranian, but Iranians are wildly overrepresented because there's this amazing cluster of them that have come to Singapore to study. So that would be like one of my favorite examples.
Well, yeah, that's definitely surprising, but at the same time, not really in terms of Iranians, because I've known quite a few of them when I went to college here in US. And actually one of my best friends, he was the best man at my wedding, he's Iranian. And he is just kind of the actual, you know, the mold of a perfect entrepreneur. And it definitely resonates a lot with the culture that they have as a country. So 100%. That's very interesting. In terms of the latest cohorts that you've seen in Entrepreneur First, what what type of skill set or maybe a domain expertise or whatever the case may be, maybe personality traits that you have been seen as a gap or more underrepresented side? What do you wish there was more of when it comes to actually pairing the good co-founders together? And I don't know if there's a technical expertise or whatever the case may be. What type of differences are you seeing? What do you wish there was more of?
Well, I think we're pretty fortunate that we get a lot of applications. We can be quite picky. I think last year we had 12,500 applications to our program. So we get to be pretty selective. I think I can tell you what's rare, and it would be, you know, it would be great to if it was less rare. I think what is a really incredible skill set in a founder, and you know, I should emphasize, we focus on the relatively more technical side of things. I mean, we fund things across the board, but you know, like most of what we do tends to have a reasonably strong technical component. I think technologists who can think in not just the technology core, but also the product layer that turns that into something useful, and then the commercial layer that makes the product a business, that is very rare. When you find it, it's magic. Someone that can operate at all three of those levels, it's an amazing thing. Because, you know, I think one misconception that I see a lot is, you know, people will see a startup raise money and, you know, it gets a lot of press, you know, maybe it's raised at a big valuation, and they'll say things like, oh, I had that idea as well, I was going to do that. And, you know, like, that's great. But so often, and, you know, I get to see this, you know, all the time because of what I do for a living, an idea that a founder thinks is unique is being pitched by 10 different people who all think that the idea is unique. And usually what makes the difference is not being first to have it, but having the most sort of comprehensive, the most nuanced, the most thought through thinking about those layers. Like, it's great that the tech is now possible, but what does that mean for the user? It's great that that works for the user, but like, how do you capture some of the value you're creating? And like, being able to operate on those three levels is pretty rare, and when it happens, it's pretty special.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely kind of very unique set, combinational, you know, just the mental frames and ability to think in that direction. I think it definitely resonates, because just being myself a technologist by trade, it's still an ongoing learning journey to be able to even have that frame of thought when it comes to building products, selling products, and bringing something to life. I think that's definitely can relate to that. Every episode I usually end with the focus on the guest itself, from a framework of what's your content diet is looking like, how do you stay ahead of the, you know, the trends, what are some of the sources that you consume on a daily basis for self-actualization, because with so much information being thrown at us on a daily basis, I'm always fascinated with how people, you know, selection strategies, what you let your mind be exposed to. Share some thoughts from that perspective.
Yeah. So I'm a real information obsessive. And actually, the thing I've found most helpful in the last 2 or 3 years for thinking about how I consume information is, maybe counterintuitively, come through writing a weekly newsletter, in which I curate and try and distill the most interesting things I've consumed. And the reason I say that is that I think before I started doing that, it was very easy to just take a totally scattergun approach to consuming information, and never really take time to think about what it means, to draw connections between the ideas that I'm being exposed to try and really think about what it means. And now, like, having created the commitment device of having a few thousand people read this newsletter every week, and knowing that I have to get it out at 7 a.m. on a Tuesday morning every week, what it does is it's really helped me focus in on, like, both quality of information rather than quantity, but also on like thematic density, like really trying to find like, well, I read this, which led me to that, which led me to this other idea. And, you know, like, what can I say about this? So I found that the discipline of having to keep notes on what I read and then try and distill that has just been really transformational for the quality of my information intake. In terms of like where I get information, I'm a bit of a Twitter junkie. My Twitter feed is extremely carefully curated. I follow quite a lot of people, and I really make an effort to follow people I disagree with, both like within my day job, but also, you know, like in politics. Like I follow people who are way to my left, way to my right, and I find that really helpful. I think just like getting out of filter bubbles is really important. I follow a lot of academics. Like I'm not an academic, and you know, I probably wouldn't have been a very good one, but I think it's like useful to like just see what is at the cutting edge of fields that are of interest. I think that's really valuable. And I do listen to a lot of podcasts. I think podcasts are super efficient. I have a young baby. I have two kids, one of whom's three and one of them's not yet a year. And the one who's not yet a year spends a lot of time awake in the night. I find that's a great time to be listening to podcasts. And you know, I love listening to podcasts where authors talk about their books, because the one thing I really miss having two young kids is uninterrupted time to read. But I love listening to podcasts where authors talk about their books. I feel I can absorb information pretty quickly that way. So yeah, between podcasts and Twitter and then a lot of newsletters these days, I find that keeps me on top of things. And then the act of distilling down for the newsletter, it's called Thoughts in Between, I found that super valuable.
I love the framework of actually, you know, from writing perspective, because like you said, it really puts you in the mindset that you almost have to do this as that particular milestone on a weekly basis, which is very interesting. And then from kids' standpoint, you know, I'm in the same boat, very young children. And, you know, from the podcast perspective, how it all came about, actually me reaching out to you guys, is I listened to your episode with Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Okay, yeah.
He's
a great guy.
Best. And you've covered a lot of really great content there. And I'm like, crap, this is so interesting. And I don't want to repeat the same questions because I, you know, what are the different trends you're excited about, which was super cool. So as I was preparing for this conversation, it was more around kind of you as a person. What was the sum of the kind of frameworks that you subscribe to? That was more kind of interesting to me. And hopefully our listeners actually, you know, respect that. Matt, I can't thank you enough for this very short but insightful conversation today. What I love doing with all the guests is do a follow-up episode in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago, see how much have changed, transpired, and basically see, you know, what are some of the things that still make sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that.
I look forward to that. That'd be great fun.
Awesome. Matt, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.